Accession number 14963, Reel 3.
Mr. Wakeman, Reel 3. Did you find it easy to learn to fly?
I wouldn't say it was easy. I found it as something that I was learning all the time. Whatever the instruction I received, it didn't soak in immediately. But I always found that when I had been instructed, when I was on my own, there was something that I had to learn. Something came up. It was always something different. I felt then that I would never know enough. But no, to start with, we went from Aberystwyth. I went to grading school at Anstey near Coventry. And we had Southam, was a little satellite field. We had some tiger moths, 5 of them there. We were billeted at Anstey Airfield itself and on a new site, brand new Nissen huts, a sea of mud. In fact, we had the concrete floor in the Nissen huts. It was all unfinished. And we had spades to scrape the mud off the floor and to brush it out. That was our billeting job before we left each morning. Scrape the mud off the floor and clean it. We had coke fires in there with no coke. It was cold as charity. But we got on a coach, a lorry, or across to Southam for our flying. And the chaps that were flying were on rest. They were obviously ex-Battle of Britain chaps. They were young. Some of them were younger than me. And one in particular, who Flight Sergeant Clayton, he was a First World War pilot who had taken me on this grading course. And I found it difficult to start with to judge when to check and hold off for landing. We'd come in on that tiger moth. You held it back. You cut the throttle and you held it back. And I was too high, always too high. And I remember Tubby Clayton saying, "Well, what were you doing before you came in the Air Force?" Well, I said, I told him where I'd worked. He says, "Yes, well, of course you probably haven't got the open air approach to this." So he said, "I kept one." So he gave me to somebody else, and I went round. But he decided that no, I was all right. That would come on, and I did my solo in 10 or 11 hours. We only had to go solo before we had to see if we could fly the thing, and.
Could I just jump ahead now to America and the training that you got there? I think that you went to America in about June 1942. Can you tell me what it was like training in America?
Yes. We'd left a training school in the grading course, which proved we could fly an aeroplane. And we went to the States and went to Ponca City. We got to... There was always lovely out in the prairies, as bags of room, and the aeroplanes, they were bigger than what we were used to. They were Stearmans, PT-17s, Boeing Stearmans. They were quite big, about 250 horsepower, as against a little tiger moth with 120. And the instructors were civilians, but they were detached from the Army Air Corps, because it wasn't the Air Force in those days, the American Army Air Corps. And they were very patient. They were very good, and they were very blunt. And they would tell you in no uncertain terms what had to be done. They would show you how you had to do it. And if you didn't do it properly, or didn't do it as they thought, they would patiently do it again, 3 or 4 times until you got the message. And then if you didn't get it right, they would come across in broad American or Anglo-Saxon English, whatever you like to call it, and you did get it right. And the Stearman, it was a difficult aeroplane to start with. It would do anything. It was a fractious beast to start with, because the damn thing would do everything that you wanted except the very thing that you were trying to do. You would fly it. It would suddenly rear up. It would turn. It would dive. It would go into a spin at the slightest provocation. But after a couple of 3 hours, you could master the thing, and it was a beautiful aeroplane, and we could fly that around, and we had a marvellous time. We went from these PT-17s on their basic training, which were Voltese. They were bigger aeroplanes. They got a fixed undercarriage, but they were about somewhere around about 500 horsepower. and they had radio, they had everything. The others were biplanes, but those are monoplanes. They were virtually small fighters, really, two-seater jobs. They were good, heavy, but they were clapped out. No trouble at all. You'd come in the circuit and you'd find the engine start misfiring and things like that. And you'd just throttle back and you had to make a glide landing. This was normal. This was accepted. But we were only on those about 6 weeks. We went on to the North American 86As. They modified them and called them Harvards over here. But they were good aeroplanes. Retractable undercarriage, 600 horsepower, two-seaters, full radio range. And we would go up and do aerobatics in those things. And sometimes you would enter into a high-speed stall. And I remember we used to have check rides every month. We used to have exams every month. They were full of exams. And check rides with a chief instructor. And he got me one day, I'd do a loop, he said. So we went into this loop. I got to the top. And it rolled off beautifully. And at that moment, the thing went straight ahead. Oh, he said, very good. He said, now do a loop. Same thing happened again, because I knew something was wrong here. I was going over in a loop. I got to the top, and the thing had rolled back upright again from upside down position. And then he told me. He let go in straight American terms what he thought of me. But he said, I'll show you. Now, he said, I'll tell you what you're doing. I said, you're pulling it back too hard. Now let the thing fly over itself. Take your hands off it. So he was right. I was pulling back on the control column and the thing was stalling. It was going in a high-speed stall. But with his Anglo-Saxon language to me up there, that really made me think. And that aeroplane went over like a bird. Rolled right over. I found then I was doing slow rolls, barrel rolls, roll off the tops, loops. And I came down there. I got a very good assessment eventually. I enjoyed it, every moment of it.
So in America, you weren't trained as part of the Arnold scheme?
No. We were on a civilian. This was a civilian airfield with a civilian, the Dar School of Aeronautics. And they had called the British Flight Training Scheme under contract to the RAF. So though we had all American equipment, we had American instructors and the American civilian instructors. In fact, some of them, like my two instructors in particular, they learned to fly the hard way. They were doing what in Canada they called bush pilots, but they could fly. And this flying that they produced for us was strictly to RAF syllabus. Everything was the RAF book form. And we did the same course you would do in England, but we did it in America with their equipment.
So there was no U.S. Air Force bull?
Well, there wasn't, but there was the bull crept in the air, that was all, and in the room. The actual RAF bull, we had a wing commander who was a chief flying instructor. We had a flight lieutenant who was the adjutant and a flight sergeant disip. Now, those three felt they had to keep the flag flying. And we had to march and parade and with the same sort of RAF discipline that we had. But it had to be that little edge so the Americans didn't think we were, well, in our language, a shower.
How did the Americans welcome you there?
Oh, they went overboard. When we got down there, the Ponca City people, they were used to the British cadets because I was on number 8 course. They'd been running 6 months then. It was 6 months after the Americans came into the war, of course. And but they were pretty well used to us, but they weren't. But they went overboard. In fact, I can remember on our leaves, I don't know how the admin people really coped because suddenly we'd have a week's leave. You needed this leave because you're flying all day, you had lectures half the day, half the flight, 6 and 7 days a week, and you needed time off because you're obviously working on your nerve ends after a time. And our first leave, suddenly the camp was empty. I don't know how they... You got 30 students of the flight going off all over the States with little money in their pockets just to have a sack with a change of gear in it, and the chief flying instructor had lost all his pupils for a week, but nobody seemed to bother. And I can remember I walked that Friday night, we finished flying in the afternoon, and two others and myself got out on the road with a haversack in our number ones, and walking up the road, they were wondering where we're going, so we head north, a highway, whatever it was, I don't know, and along came an old Studebaker, one of those Studebaker coupes. It was muddy and dirty and battered. Unusual thing, the chap pulled up and said, "The old fellas want a lift?" He says, "Sure, well, I'm a-going Wichita way." Oh, well, that'd do for us. We didn't know where Wichita was. That would do. So we joined him. And he just said, puzzled silence for a bit. And he said, "Well, what outfit you fellas in then?" So I said, "We're in the RAF. We're learning to fly at Ponca City." "What, you mean British?" I said, "That's right, yeah, British." "Well, goddamn. He fumbled in his back pocket, brought out half a bottle of whiskey. Said, "You guys are going to have a drink with me." He said, "Plenty more where that came from." Out came the whiskey bottle. We had to drink with sup this, because we weren't all that used to whiskey anyway. But he insisted. He took us right up to Wichita, about 100 miles away. Found a small hotel on the outskirts, dumped us there, and he was still muttering to himself as he drove off there. I'm sure there were whiskey fumes coming out the exhaust of that car, because the old Studebaker was going up there, steering itself up the road. We went in there, booked in at this hotel, about $2 a night, I think. It was a cheap little place, but what the hell, we only had $40 a month's pay. So, next morning, we came out, we smartened up, we thought, well, this is it, polished up our buttons, and polished up our gear, shaved, bright shoes. We went out, and we're walking up into the centre of the town, and we found another USO service canteen. We went in there, thought we'd have a coffee or whiskey with something, cornflakes or something. And we went and sat down at the table there with a coffee. We hadn't been sitting there a couple of minutes. And some big American soldier came over there. He had a cigar sticking out of his mouth there, like a candle. Says, "Well, say, what outfit you fellas in then?" "Oh, well, we were service," and he was. So he said, "Well, we're in the Royal Air Force." "What, you mean British Royal Air Force?" That's right. "Well, goddamn. Say, fellas, these guys are from the Air Force." So from that moment on, we didn't have a chance. They carried over. They got their women, their girlfriends, their mothers, they called their service mothers, they called them, would look after us. And for 3 days, they whipped us around town. We went to dances. We were entertained. We were given rides, viewing the city, and God knows what. It was wonderful. We couldn't do anything. Eventually, we really had to break off to get on the road again. We only had a week's leave, and we were there for 3 days. And half the night we were up. We were heading down up to Kansas City. And the same thing happened up there. Same list we got. They couldn't do enough for us. Of course, remember, they hadn't seen British people like that. This was only 6 months after the war. They'd been in the war, just over 6 months. And they didn't know what British service people were like. They really, out there in that independent Midwestern states, they really didn't know. They didn't know what went on beyond their own borders, virtually. When they found that we spoke English and they didn't understand half what we said, they went overboard. They did all the entertaining one could ever hope to meet. We were treated like film stars, I suppose. We had to broadcast one hotel. Bank president took us in his house, put us up for the night. And this was a real house, and a real, real bank president, not like the ones that we'd ever been used to. I went to the dinner. Went to a dinner at a hotel. A marvelous thing. First time I'd ever had Benedictine in my life. I said, "You must try this after him." And we were on our best behaviour, of course. And they thought that was marvelous. There was the band playing. I can remember his name now, Chuck Foster, and he was broadcasting. So he said, "I've got some RAF boys in the audience here. Now come up, fellas, and have a word." We had to broadcast, tell them who we were, where we'd come from, what we were doing. It was most embarrassing. We never spoke to a microphone before, and that's the broadcasting in Kansas, from Kansas City. Well, it was out of this world. But they couldn't do enough for us, and really, it spoiled us. In fact, it was a good thing we came back to the States after 9 months, came back to the UK after 9 or 10 months.
Now, if we can jump ahead again to your operational squadron, 640 Squadron, Leconfield, flying Halifaxes, can you tell me how you arrived at that station, please?
Yes. It goes back about a month or two before that, because I'd been staff piloting for a long time in the Southwest, and I got a burst appendix. I whipped into a hospital and that sort of thing. I came out, given a good leave, and just got back on the station again. And obviously, it delayed my posting somewhat, because I was in hospital from about December till February. And they whipped me onto Bomber Command from there. So I was sent up to Lossiemouth on Wellington's to convert for Bomber Command operational flying. Did that course. Went down to Rickall for four group Rickall onto Halifax 2s to convert onto the operational aircraft. And we did the course there. That was a brief course, I don't know, about 3 weeks, I suppose. And it was some pretty rough weather. And we went down to Le Havre, really, on a gun position, down the last trip. We came back. Diverted because of fog, it just managed to get into Bern, bounced off the runway and onto the grass, not the runway, turned up there, and we had to leave the aeroplane there because it couldn't get off. I went back to transport to Rickall and found I got a big notice on the flight door, list of posting where you'd like to go. So I had no particular choice. But some of the boys seemed to think Leconfield was a good place because it was a good quarters there. So that seemed to be the way I got to Leconfield. So I left them to make the choice. Not particularly squadron, but the station itself because of its accommodation. They were right too. It was a good station to be at. So next day, we got our posting through. It was Leconfield, as they asked for. And by the end of the week, we were at Leconfield.
Can you tell me what it was like to fly the Lancaster, the Halifax, in 1944, please?
Yes, the two Halifaxes that I flew, the Mark II modified, had Merlin engines. They were really clapped out aeroplanes, but they flew quite well, providing all four kept running. Now, when I got to Leconfield, we had the Mark III Halifax with Hercules engines. Well, of course, the Merlin's an inline job, and Hercules is a radial job, a 14-cylinder radial. The Merlin, a 24 inline cylinder. They were altogether different characteristics. One was liquid-cooled, the other air-cooled. So when it got on the runway with these Halifax, of course, by this time, we had the big square fins on the Halifax. The previous triangular fins used to get a rudder stall. And if you got a bit slow or you got knocked out of position, that would go into an ever-decreasing turn. And nothing you could do to get out of it. You had to jump out and leave it. It never happened to me, fortunately. But with the Halifax 3, we got the big size square-finned rudders with a good airstream. We could pick up a good airstream from the air screws, which that didn't happen any longer. And we'd taken out the front turret, so we lightened it considerably. It was too heavy before, so it was lightened considerably. But the only thing, got onto the runway, and you had a job. I was fortunate, having flown radials for years, trained on them, but these radials, these were, 1,600 horsepower each, and there were four of them. And they're all turning the same way. You open up the throttles. If you had to keep your wits about you, because if you didn't open up the starboard, that is a right-hand throttle far in advance, and get it moving, it would swing. The aircraft would swing off to the right and leave the runway, and no way could you do anything about straightening it up. But you got the trick. You open up the throttles until she was running straight, and you suddenly got this airstream over your big fins at the right, on the tail, and you could hold it. And you could open up the two port engines, the left ones, and give it full boost. And she would go. And round about 100 knots, you start lifting off the runway. And you use a lot of runway, but not too much. And if you didn't get a crosswind would accentuate the swing from the engines, the torque motion of the air screws. It would accentuate it worse, and it would be a devil of a job to get it straight. But if you were aware of this, if you've been using those type of engines, and you've got a crosswind, you could get full rudder on one side, full throttle on the other, and you'd hold it straight till you got control of it. I was a little unfortunate being on the short side. I'm only 5'6.5 to 7", and I couldn't reach the rudder pedals properly. And on my right rudder, I had to hook my foot under the strap on the rudder pedal and pull it back and hold the throttle wide open on the right and push with my left foot to keep it straight with a full bomb load and full fuel load. It was a pretty sluggish aeroplane. But then it got moving, and you got this 6,000 horsepower pulling you along, four of them, and 1,600 horsepower each, and that would move. That would go. It'd lift up, and no time at all, you could pull the throttle back, that plus 2,400 revs, and you climb away, 1,000 feet a minute, no trouble at all. And it's a beautiful aeroplane. Once in the sky, it would light on the controls, it was maneuverable, and it would really climb. It would go up to about 20,000 feet, and you could operate at 17,000 to 18,000 feet comfortably. That was a nice aeroplane to fly. Excuse me.
What impression did you get of the squadron when you arrived?
When I first arrived there, it was a good, friendly squadron, full of no bull, all camaraderie among all the people there. I walked onto that squadron the first afternoon. It was a Saturday, and went to see Wing Commander Moore. Unfortunately, a couple of weeks later, he was killed. But I went to see this flight commander and Bob Rooney, an Australian. He was his deputy. Hello, Jimmy. He called me Jim in those days for some reason. It was a nickname that I picked up. And let's have a fly around the circuit, have a look at the area. So, just like that, we got an aeroplane. He did one circuit with me. He said, "There it is, she's all yours. You have to take her around, flog her around for an hour, see what you think of it." That was the approach. No bull. So there was I. I'd never been in a Mark III Halifax before with Hercules engines. And he just handed the thing over as if it was a Ford car. Go and have a look around, have a go. They trusted you. They knew what you'd been doing. I was a flight sergeant at the time. So obviously I've got enough experience that they appreciated. And we flogged around, got it around, landed. It was all right. Two or three circuits, down again. So I thought, well, we call this off now. We didn't even know where the mess was. We'd only got to get our arrival chit signed. So we said, we're going to get some tea. We found out where the mess was. We went down, got some tea, the mess. We were planning the evening where we'd go. So I thought, well, go and have a look at the local hostelries. It'd be a couple of 3 days. We'd do some cross countries before we get onto ops or anything of that sort. So we should be all right. We'd go and have a few jugs at the local hostelries. So we got the Liberty truck down to Beverly. And that was the time we first found the Valiant Soldier. He went in there for a game of darts. Had a few beers, came back. I went to bed about midnight, I suppose, eventually, at the sergeant's mess. 3 o'clock in the morning, the tannoy bellowing is right outside my door. Meals, 3:30. Main briefing, 0400 for the following cruise. And there it was, top of the list. Flight Sergeant Wakeman. I thought, well, I've only just come here. I don't know where the things are, where the aeroplanes are, least of all, what's going on. So I thought, the wireless operator came banging in. Did you hear that? We're on tonight. So I said, this is tonight. That's tomorrow morning. I said, get the crew out. Let's get down to briefing. I don't know. I haven't got a clue. So anyway, we got a briefing. Went down. I didn't see the flight commander was down there. He came over, hello, old boy, he says, sorry about this, but I thought you'd like it. He says, it's not worth stooging around across country. You're only going over to some gun positions over there. There's no problem, we don't want to do across country for this. I said, yeah, yes, sir. Well, where's the aeroplanes? Oh, don't worry about that, old boy. The WAF drivers know them all. So I thought, well, I don't know. I don't even know where to get a parachute, let alone anything else. Get it fitted up. Get a dump, got my own helmet, of course, and that sort of gear. And so, anyway, went to briefing. Went there, and strange enough, that squadron, everything went like a dream. Nothing happened. It was all went off. As he said, the wife driver knew them all. They took us out of the aeroplane. That was it. I mean, the flight sergeant in charge out there, the ground mechanics, yes, sir. Everything was beautiful. The only thing that happened was, the Forêt de Nîmes, I think, was the first trip. I can't remember it completely. I believe it was a flying bomb site. I don't really remember. The only thing that happened was they fired about one gun, and that a lump of that hit my windscreen and splintered it. But I don't think much else fired. And he came back again, and, that was all right. It was our first trip over. We went back to the mess. Nothing much. We was on again the next day. But there's a lovely spirit among the boys. Everybody, I wouldn't say knew each other by name, but you're such a friendly. You knew each other by mate or cobber or something like that. It didn't matter.
What was the composition of your crew?
The composition, we had seven in a crew. There was Cliff Morrison. He was my bomb aimer, because we didn't have dual controls, but he was an ex-pilot, didn't make the grade, so went bomb aiming, so he was a good chap to have. My navigator, he was a bit older than me, he was about 6-7 years older, Reg Parr. He was really one of the tennis club sort of chaps, quite a nice fellow, but he wasn't all that bright as, he knew his arithmetic for navigation, but he was a bit too nice for this sort of job. But anyway, he was all right for what he had to do. He was a navigator, a good navigator in the long run. Wireless operator, he was Harry Berryman. Now, he was one of Chelsea Reserve's football players. He was a young fella, about 20. And the mid-upper gunner, he was another elderly chap of about 37. He was Tommy Thomas. He was from Birmingham, and he was manager of a builder's yard. Before he came down here, he didn't seem fully awake to what he was doing, I don't think, but nevertheless, he sat up in that top turret all right. And a rear gunner, he was an active young fella of 20, 21, and Eric. He was one for the girls. He was always posing, that tall and slim, and full of life. He was a good chap, actually. He had a good gunner, too. I liked him in the rear turret. He felt safe with him behind. I had to pull him up several times. I wasn't much older than he was. But somebody had to pull him up because he was too enthusiastic. He'd have us corkscrewing all over the sky for no problems at all. If he saw a star, he'd have us corkscrewing because he thought it was a fighter. But sure, when the fighters did come in, he still had his corkscrewing, so it was all right in that respect. The engineer... Now, we only picked him up just before he got there, so I didn't know him, dearie. That was Peter McPhee. But he was a fitter too. Ground trade changed to flying. And he was a wonderful chap, but he knew his engines. He knew what it was all about. But I couldn't understand a word he was saying on the intercom. He was from the Outer Hebrides or somewhere like that, and I couldn't understand his accent. I couldn't understand him. But he was a chap who'd married, about 33. He was very, very nice, very steady, and he would always have a tin of sweets in his pocket. You get in the cockpit there, he said, have a sweetie before we go. And then from then on, when the engine started, the intercom come on, I never knew a word what he was saying. It was sign language. He'd come and tap my shoulder and put his thumb up. Yeah, and I'd take that to me with enough fuel to carry on, or everything was all right, or something of that sort. And if I wanted him, I'd get somebody else to talk, pull his earpiece off and talk to shout in his ear. It was easier to communicate that way. He was a good fellow.
Now, you said you couldn't remember a great deal about...